The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Amy Tan, who came to London from her home in the west coast of America to talk about her name-making novel, The Joy Luck Club. Describing the life of Chinese Americans, this international bestseller is really a collection of stories about immigrant mothers and their daughters. It's structured in the shape of the Chinese board game Mahjong. So our host, John Mullin, asked Amy if you had to know how to play Mahjong to understand the book fully.
I can say with absolute authority, no, because I don't play Mahjong.
You're kidding!
No. Some of these things we do, you know, with inspiration from the Mahjong muses. Everything that's in there about Mahjong was told to me directly by my mother. And I asked her that question. What's the difference between Chinese Mahjong and Jewish Mahjong? And she said over the phone, oh, not the same thing at all, you know. And then she goes on to describe this Jewish Mahjong, no strategy, you know. And I wrote it down verbatim, and that's what that is. So that's as much as I know about Mahjong.
But it's got a geometry, hasn't it? It's got a pattern. It's got 4x4 thing.
Four sides, yeah. And there's a degree of skill where you don't look at things. Like my mother played without looking at the tiles. She could feel. She could watch other people and see what they were doing. And I think in that sense, you know, you have these mothers who have been watching silently all those years. And the daughter now has to try to take that mother's place at the table and really is inadequate, has to look at the tiles and doesn't understand what they mean.
Well, I think 20-odd years on, sort of structural tricks in quite popular novels are more common. But this thing of having the four sections with, you know, four storytellers. I mean, I'm glad to say there is a kind of chapter guide, section guide at the beginning where you can see the pattern. Was that pattern there before the stories were there, or was it a kind of eureka moment?
I was very naive, a beginning writer in many respects. And then when things started coming together as I was writing, I thought it was getting very confusing. So I have to put everybody in little areas, and I started grouping them according to characteristics that they had, and it became four. And then somebody, my editor, said, would you write four section beginnings? So then I wrote four of that. I had somebody do a thesis on this number four, and I found out that I probably used some combination of four about 40,000 times, not being aware of what I was doing. But I also knew, here's the other thing, there are four chapters and four sections, and some of that was related to the fact that I was told I had to deliver, I think, 100,000 words, and at the time I didn't know what that was, and I counted them up and how many pages, and I realized I was missing one chapter. I had 15 originally.
Most of the time, the narrator seemed to be talking to the reader rather than to each other.
Yeah.
You know, so particularly with the mothers and the daughters, the mothers tell their stories, but they tell their stories to you, and because it's all first-person narration and they're in these boxes, it has, I mean, it feels as though that's a really appropriate structure, because it feels like there are lots of people with stories, but they don't necessarily tell each other their stories.
Yeah, I wrote about this language, this issue of who is saying what, in an essay called Mother Tongue. In the sections, whenever the mother is talking, giving her story, she has a particular kind of English. When she is speaking to her daughter, she typically has a very broken English. And I was trying to capture a language that would be more like what I imagine these women, how they would speak in Chinese. But of course, since I'm writing in English, I had to render it that way. It's their internal language that's there. And they are talking a little bit to themselves, but at the same time, I think wishfully, it would be what they would say.
Most of these daughters, their mothers have various kind of superstitions, as I would call them.
Yeah.
And the daughters, however skeptical, pretty much eventually always seem to kind of concede that maybe at least it's safest to go along with it, or even maybe mum actually knows something.
You know, I have these different parts of me, and I try to sound sane and rational, and I can cite all the scientific evidence why a mother, this particular mother's beliefs are magical. But I have been in situations where the magic really works, and so often that I, like my mother, I'm open to anything. I'm a pragmatic person at this stage in my life. I'm old enough to say I don't care if you think I'm dumb. I'm just going to go with what seems to be the case. It happened, in fact, when I was at in a mountain village for 3 weeks, living among the Dong minority people, with being with a feng shui master, and hearing him talk about what was going on here—ghost, you know, possession and things—and being there after a while, I started to take hold of these beliefs. That was the way this world operated. And so I'm very easily seduced in the way that I hope a reader is seduced when they read a book like this and they believe everything.
Yeah. In this story, the daughters all appear to want to be American. Mm-hmm. It looks like kind of the mother's accounts of things really win out, actually. The mothers get the best lines, in a way.
You know, the mothers were easier for me to write than the daughters. Part of it is a shedding of self-consciousness. You know, I was a little too close to the daughters and feeling that this was me being exposed. Whereas the mothers were, it's that subterfuge of fiction that I am drawn into and they're hiding there and I think that I'm saying something else. And really, I end up saying the things that I know better that are difficult. And so those mother characters came out. It is very much my mother's voice, but it's then my understanding of all these things that she had said over the years, the kind of intentions. My brother, he said to me once, he said, I know that's not mom, and I know she didn't say all those things, but it sounds exactly like how she would have said those things. And that was a compliment to me. Yes, some of the things she actually said, and I wrote them down and I put them in there because they were funny.
Because I was thinking, you were saying about the language thing, and it's a real topic of the novel. And the daughters seem, on quite a few occasions, to sort of be taught by the events of their life that actually, far from their mothers being sort of inarticulate, they have to sort of, it's they who are inarticulate in a way.
You know, in those expressions, there's a whole emotional component, image, experience, history that's encapsulated in that word so that nothing else in English would express what she felt at that time, what hey mong mong or whatever it is meant. I would hear these phrases, and they even today, my husband, who's not Chinese, we have these words that we say in Chinese, they sum up a situation. Mother wisdom, that's in that phrase. Mother maddening wisdom, actually. I was constantly finding epiphanies from my life as I was writing this. My mother had a way, an uncanny way of translating things incorrectly, and yet it would be the meaning, it would be the correct meaning. And I wanted to capture that irony, that paradoxical truth. I think that the mothers also have come through lives that are much more difficult and that they had to be very practical, very pragmatic, very clever and persistent in coming up ways to escape fate in a way. And the daughters, you know, Americans use their ingenuity, their kind of cleverness, their negotiation skills. What my mother could do is just use any kind of truth, any belief system. Whatever worked was what she would apply. So it would, you know, be trickery, it'd be belief in superstitions, it could be borrowing help from somebody. So that's what you get, you know, with a person like Lindo. To my mind, Lindo is the most like my mother. My mother, she's passed away. Lindo was so easy to write. You know, I just imagined my mother and I just wrote
it. Did your mother read the novel?
Oh, yeah, she did.
And did she recognize that aspects of herself in it?
She didn't say, oh, I'm more like this mother than that mother. What she thought was that I had listened and understood her. She said, oh, you're just like me. You know now, because she read this. And she was like Lindo in her cleverness in getting things, but the very sad parts, the kind of regretful yin-yang kind of mother was also who my mother was. Ying Ying is almost suicidal. That was more like my mother. Mm. An Mei, the tragic mother, a woman who's remembering what happened to her mother, killing herself and doing this sacrifice and watching her mother die. That was something that actually happened to my mother, and she recognized that story.
What, something she saw or something happened to her?
That's what she saw, her mother cutting her flesh to make a soup for her mother as she was dying. And that she also, her mother took the opium and was lying there for 3 days, and she was at her bedside asking her not to leave. So that was a true story. That was based on something that happened.
I want to ask you about the title, because given some of the painful memories that are sort of being dug up in their stories, the title looks quite ironical in a way, but the Joy Luck Club of this book, in a way, is a structure within which people do tell bad stories or stories of past unhappiness.
It might have been the mahjong table. It was often the kitchen table as they're preparing food. And it was almost like therapy. Instead of going to psychiatrists, they would be talking about their past, and you just had to listen. And, you know, I think the quality that was important at these meetings is that you had an audience. You had an audience that didn't speak and didn't judge. These women had been through the same thing. They understood each other. So they just could talk. And the thing that separated them then, they had a shared past, the same kind of tragedies, but what separated them was how their daughters were doing. And so they would kind of brag about their daughters. And, you know, there you would have some differences showing up. Joy Luck Club, however, you know, I put that name down there, and I never intended that to be the name of the book.
Oh, right.
I had a very prosaic name that was Wind and Water. And the reason I chose that, well, it was like feng shui, and it was a balance of things. And I gave that to my agent. She had asked, you know, what would a whole book of these stories look like? And I just jotted down stories, you know, very quickly one afternoon, gave them titles off the top of my head. And the first story was going to be The Joy Luck Club. I put down They Gathered, this woman's dead and discovers something about sisters. My agent said, I love this title, The Joy Luck Club. And I said, really? Well, it's not very exciting. And she said, what do you mean? I think it's great. Well, I grew up with the real Joy Luck Club. So to me, it sounded like the Girl Scouts. You know, and it just wasn't special. My parents and some other people started this thing called the Joy Luck Club. And what they do here is exactly what they did. They invested in stocks. They talked through the night, ate dim sum. And we were the kids who were together in the back rooms, but wandering out, we'd hear them talking. And that was, you know, they believed in luck a lot, but it was modern luck. It was Chinese luck, but it was also stock market luck. and so, you know, it was the idea that you could grab a little bit of both worlds.
But your agent was right.
But just like the number four, I don't always see the obvious. I didn't see the obvious when I turned in the whole collection. And to me, it was a collection of short stories and not a novel. When my editor saw them, she later had called me in for a meeting, and we went through them. And she said, there's only one story that doesn't fit. And I said, yes. And she said, this one, it's about a daughter and her husband. I said, yes. She said, well, the other ones are about a daughter and a mother. I said, oh, yes, right. Even that part of it was not so obvious to me.
Yeah.
I then looked and made that story more strongly angled toward the mother.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Just a couple of more things I wanted to ask you about before I throw it open. And one was that. I mean, the men, I suppose, the husband.
Yeah. You know, it was supposed to be intimate. I simply wanted to hear this voice and the other voice, and I wanted to find out what was not coming together and yet was united in a way, what things were just going by. And I couldn't do that if I gave emphasis to the men and any kind of equal treatment. So they're there basically as foils. there simply to help bring out the crises.
Yes.
And, you know, there are four of them. They all have bad marriages. But, you know, my fifth marriage has been quite successful. Now, I've been with the same guy for 44 years. I thought I would just assure you that this is not a reflection of any marriage of mine.
44 years.
44 okay. years, yeah.
So I want to ask you about the ending. And of course, it has a kind of structural polish about it, really. You start with June, you end with June. She goes to China to meet these once lost, for decades mm-hmm. lost, mm-hmm. twin yeah. half-sisters yeah. of hers.
That was going to be the end point, because when I started outlining this, it was just before I went to China for the first time and I was going to meet those daughters my mother left behind. Well, I met two of them that first trip. So it was with anticipation of the feeling I might have that was listening to my mother's stories and leading up to going to China.
So was that chapter, was it influenced by your own experience then, was it?
It influenced my expectations when yes. I actually had my meeting, my first meeting of these sisters. It was influenced by the expectations, but no, June's actual meeting with it is shaped by the fact that her mother has died. And yeah. what she's looking for in the sisters is that connection.
Yeah.
I didn't need to find that with those sisters. I was seeing women who had a connection, but I wasn't trying to look for my mother in them. She was standing right there.
So who would like to ask Amy a question?
You compare China and the USA. Do you have actual views on which is the better place to live?
Oh, definitely. The USA now, the air quality in China is horrible. Oh. You know, I don't have these dichotomies. Some of them come across as, you know, are you more Chinese, more American? Is this better? Is that better? I've come to, over the years, believe that everything is a transitory target, and it really depends on a context. And so the context, in the case of whether it's better to live in China or the United States, is very much what are you looking for? What is the meaning you're looking for? And there could be a time in my life that I feel I would want to be in China because I'll be closer to what it is that I need to discover. On the other hand, it really is true. I have friends, expats who live in China, and air quality is a huge issue. So for that reason, I probably would not live in China for a long time. I would like to live there and get my Chinese, you know, up to speed, but and I know I would discover all kinds of things, all kinds of secrets. I have still family secrets coming out. If I spent time with my family and had better Chinese, I know I would be able to hear a lot more of them.
I have a Chinese mother myself who's 90 and blind and lives with me, and she had heart failure this year and nearly died, and so I felt, when your mother was alive, did you ever try to influence her to try and make her be less negative? Her favorite phrase is, I dare not.
I dare not.
She lived through the war, and she's right. number 13 of family of 16.
Yeah. You know, I said it wrong to my mother. I would say things like, why are you so negative? So I was never, what I needed to do was say, tell me why you feel this way, and just listen for about 90 days to the same story, and which is what I did when I was writing the book. And after reading the book, she did change. And it had everything to do with my simply listening to her. And she wanted me to be her witness, in other words. She wanted me to go back to the past and be with her and said, yes, you had a terrible life, and so did your mother, and I am there to understand and be there and just feel as bad as you did back then. That's what she wanted. The one time, you know, I changed, her attitude completely changed, was when she had Alzheimer's. And she said to me for the very first time, I'm happy, I have no worries. Part of it is learning how to remove the worry, and the other is just being there to remove the regret. I feel that much of the book is about identity, self-identity, mothers being a huge part of that self-identity, and that who we become has much to do with how we handle hardships. These mothers have had many more hardships. They're in the graduate school, the postdoc school of hardships, and the daughters are looking at, you know, very elementary things in their life and thinking they are huge hardships, and they have no idea. they probably will go through a number of them.
I thought my mother was a great exaggerator. I still think she's a great exaggerator, actually. But, you know, reading about some of the atrocities of war, reading about the hardships, I just didn't connect that to what my mother had said. And reading your book somehow gave me that connection.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say thanks.
Thank you. I remember asking my mother, after I had written this book, I started to write a second book. And by my mother's request, she had said, make the next book all about me. I resisted writing her true story until I realized there was nothing more meaningful than getting more of her story. So the second book is really about that. During the writing of that, though, I asked her about the war. She was in Guilin. She was also in Chongqing and Shanghai and other places. So I asked her about the time she lived in Kunming. And she was there and one day talked about how the Japanese planes come and they didn't know which side of the city they were going to bomb. So they would guess and they would run to this side of the city or that side and hoping that they would guess correctly. Now, my mother had said before when asked about the war, she said she didn't have very many stories because she wasn't affected. And so when she told me that, I said, how could you say you weren't affected? And she said, I wasn't. I wasn't killed. You know. So this is a difference in what we mean by not affected. And it just hit me over and over and over again when she say things like this, that, you know, we just speak different languages, you know, when it comes to gradations of hardship. I wanted to have a mother-daughter dictionary, you know, and you define things. You know, what is hardship, regret, you know, all these different things. And you give examples and have them, and you see what the discrepancy is and why there's a huge language gap.
I read your book after my mother died, who was Chinese, and it actually gave me an understanding I never had before. I didn't grow up speaking Mandarin, which she did. You helped me see, understand her more. I was hoping you'd help me understand her even further by giving your view on why a Chinese mother wouldn't teach their child their native tongue.
In my mother and father's case, they mistakenly believed that if we learned Chinese, we would not be able to learn English that well. And that was very unfortunate because, of course, a child can learn any number of languages that it just, the child picks it up naturally, picks up languages naturally and accommodates many of them. The good thing is that my mother's English was so poor that she often spoke in Chinese to friends and to other people, so that when I was growing up, until I went to school, I must have heard Chinese a lot. When I was an adult, I did not speak much more than how are you? Ni hao ma. When I went to China, I couldn't say much more than that to my sisters. But now, somehow, just being around them and being forced to speak, Chinese has come back to me. It's in there. When my sister comes to visit me and stays in the house with me for 10 days, all we speak is Chinese. Or when we're in China, and there's a quality of our interaction that is seems to be, you know, shaped by the Chinese language itself. The things that are said with a lot of gestures. It's not just the words. It's a whole, do you believe me? And I'm confiding in you. It just reminded me so much of what I grew up with. So I treasure having that language, the nuances of intent that is in your mother's tongue.
And I do wonder, this generation, subsequent to the generation that fled China, whether we can ever make up for the hardships that the previous generation endured, and whether we will carry that guilt.
You know, when I think of the previous generation, I think not only of my mother's generation, but those who went through the Cultural Revolution, as did my sisters. With my mother, the way that I would do anything to repair what they went through or help them, it was to become successful and to help them and help my mother in her senior years. But I think about my sisters who were left behind in China by my mother when she came to the United States in 1949. Those girls were in Shanghai and she didn't see them for 30 years. They worked in the countryside. They were sent down because they had a mother in America. And I used to think about, one of my sisters would tell me about her life, that she had been working in a rice field for 19 years. She could have left earlier, but she remained in that city for 19 years. And that she would be pulling, you know, harvesting the rice, pulling leeches off her legs. And when she was telling me that, I thought that could have been my life. I could have been one of her daughters left behind. And you think about these twists of fate or our circumstances, the luck of our own lives, our birthright, or all these different factors. I don't think that we're born in this world to expiate the sins of revolution or to somehow even the tally of parents' regrets for tragedies that they've been through. But I think that what has been important in our family is to understand very much how these situations have shaped them and how they are a part of us too, that their histories are a part of us, that we're connected by them. And that's, you know, very much what I feel with my sisters. You know, that sense of what a mother meant to them and their loss of that mother all those years, you know, knowing what they had to endure. But I do have to also tell you that when they came to the United States and they would be around my mother and me and for many, many days, and they saw how my mother would criticize and, no, you didn't cook that right, and, oh, this tastes bad, you know, who said you could cook? You know, all this kind of stuff. Day in and day out, I looked at them one day and they said, oh, you are very strong. I said, yeah, you thought it was all tender, mother. Oh, you know, Amy, you're so pretty, you know, and you're so sweet. And I said, no. And they said, yes, you were brave. I didn't know the thing about the rice field until I went to a place in China, Guizhou, which is the poorest and most remote province in China. I went to live there on three occasions to live among rice farmers who earned about $70 a year, the whole family. Very poor place. Be out in the rice fields with them, go up and down the mountains with them. And I told my sister when I was going to go there for a second or third time, she said, what's so special about that? And I, you know, rice farm. She said, I did that for 19 years.
I'd just like to know, what influence did your father have on your life?
Very good question. My father was quite different. He was somebody who had, he was a Christian. His father, his family, his entire family were evangelical Christians. He spoke fairly good English, I would say pretty close to perfect. My grandfather on that side of the family spoke and wrote and read English. English was his first written language. My father was a happy person. Everybody liked him. He was social. He was not superstitious. He was modern. He was positive. He believed that if you prayed or if you believed in something, it would happen. He was very consistent. If he never drank, he never smoked. And I was a daddy's girl, and I very much admired him. We had secret times when we'd go out. My mother would be mad at me or at him, and we'd go off and commiserate together. And he would read to me Word Power from the Reader's Digest, and we would learn words together. So he was a very special person to me, and the only problem is he died. And I actually was angry that he died. I felt he had abandoned me to this crazy woman. And I now was in charge of interpreting for my mother the way he had had to interpret. So you may have noticed when you read the books that a lot of the really good men die young. They die early. And people have asked me, you know, do you ever think that you would write about your father or have a character like that? I think it would be very difficult because from a child's memory, he's not flawed enough. He doesn't have a complexity to him. He's just a little too perfect. And so for me to be able to write about him, I would have to give him the flaws, and I would have to look for them, and it would be very painful to see him that way. And I have seen some things. I have seen how some of his Christian beliefs sort of was a veneer over things that were very difficult, that were not going to be ever solved by the kind of words that were used. You know, believe and it will be, you know, everything will come out okay, because everything didn't come out okay. But someday I will maybe find a character that would be more like him.
On your behalf, I'm sure you want me to thank Amy. Thanks very much on everybody's behalf.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.